obvious here at this point in the gospel is that there is now crowds that are gathering around it. Like we're suddenly landed with this great crowd of 5,000 around Jesus as he feeds them. But actually we've got into this sense of almost mob mentality, I think, as you get to this point in the gospel, as you see these people pursuing Jesus. And I think that there's a tension here between what the motivations are for this crowd. I think there's, for some people, it's bound to be that sense of almost voyeurism as they look at Jesus and they go, well, what's this guy going to do next? Because he's done some pretty good stuff. We want to see what he's going to say, what he's going to do. We want to see him go up against the authorities because, do you know what, that's exciting. It's like a docu-soap, isn't it? It's like that sense of people, you know, there is that sense within all of us that we just want to see what's going on. And you see these great crowds now gathered around Jesus, just wanting to know what on earth is going to happen next. And I think that that's John's suddenly introduced that at this point in the gospel. And it's important at this point, because then when we get to the end of this chapter, and we're not going to look much into this, we see this great dropping away of all of these disciples. That Jesus says some pretty hard things, some controversial things, maybe some really direct things to the people. And we see this sense of all of these people just sort of drifting away as they just can't cope with how direct Jesus is being, the challenge that Jesus is bringing them. So therefore, John is giving just once again this dualism, these two things, saying, look, on the one hand, there's all of these people that want to pursue Jesus, but then on the other hand, there's only a few that will get it. There's only a few that will understand. There's only a few that will actually hold on to the words of Jesus and truly take them into their heart, into their life, so that they might be changed. Jesus actually very quickly strips away some of this stuff. And he does it in a brilliant way that I don't think I would be able to. And that says something more about Jesus than it does about me. This sense of, look, what are you doing? You're following me because you've had your belly filled. He makes this contrast between the people, those that are just, because actually they've had a great feed. They've filled themselves up. And it is free food, isn't it? I mean, I've been to enough church lunches. I observe Thursday Cafe every month. And people get excited about free food. It's like the Samba. If you've ever been to Costco, anybody here been to Costco? The way that people gather around the free sample trolleys at Costco tells you, I think, about some of this mentality that people will go out of their way to find that bit of fruit, that bit of fruit, or the sample counters that they have in Sainsbury's as well. You just find people hanging around waiting till, and if there's nobody there, they'll just sort of linger in, because free food does something to people. But actually Jesus sees right to the heart of these people. There's this sense of, well, we might get fed if we follow him around, but actually Jesus just cuts through all of that in such a simple way. Just cuts to the heart of it all. Strips them back to what they really are doing. And then we get into this area, and it's very much connects back to what we were talking last week about works. We said last week we used, I think it's verse 17 of chapter 5, didn't we, to say, my Father is always at work to this very day, and I too am working, as a sign of Jesus connecting us to this bit of Trinitarian theology, to know that Jesus is one and the same with God, that he is by nature both unified and equal with God. And that was part of the tension to the things that we were looking at last week. And that we're kind of building on that sense of, well, what then is, what does it mean for us to work? That actually, if we've got this challenge before us, that there are things that we need to do, then what is actual work? What is the work that we need to do? And Jesus says this so very simply. The work of God is this: to believe in the one he has sent. It's so simple, isn't it? That's what's, as I was thinking about this week, it strikes me again and again how simple this is. Because it shifts everything. It genuinely just shifts everything, because it says that it's not about what you do day to day. That actually it's not about this filling your columns with credit thing that we so easily, that mentality that we so easily get into. It's not about doing good out in the world just to give yourself a great big tick in your column. It really isn't. And Jesus strips all of that away with just these simple words. He just says, this is the works that God requires. This is the qualification with which you need to hold your, it's only about this. To believe in the one he has sent. Because it means that it's not about those works, but it's about relationship. It's about faith in God, in Jesus Christ. How simple that is. How simple that is, how profound that is, how much that should change us. And again, because it strips away so much of the law is about doing this, doing that, complying with this, fulfilling the law, fulfilling this work of righteousness through the law by the activity that we do. Jesus brings this critique to these followers and says, no, it's about your belief in me. It's about relationship with me. It's this grace. There's a reason why Paul spends so much time unpacking this, isn't it? If you read further on into the letters of Paul, that actually he spends so much time just kind of playing around this theme, taking these words of Jesus and just saying, look, here's what it's about. Here's works of grace. Here's, but this is the unit. It's about faith. It's about faith. It's about faith, Paul keeps saying. And it comes back to this principle that takes us away from the law to this new covenant of grace. It's not tit for tat. It's not a transaction. It's about belief in the one he has sent. What comes next, I think, is perhaps another adventure in missing the point, but it's also very much about the subtext that comes with it. Because having made bold statements about what it means to take faith above works, Jesus now unpacks what was going on with Moses and manna. So having looked at Elisha, recall us back to that memory, that covenantal memory of Elisha, that John, through the gospel, Jesus, through these words, pulls us very much back to Moses and what happens in the desert. That this is Jesus standing above and beyond Moses. In the same way, perhaps, that John wants us to see that Jesus is above and beyond Elisha. Because in both of these places, it was not Moses who provided the manna. And that's an easy mistake to make, isn't it? It's not Moses who provides the manna. You can imagine that across the decades, across the generations, that it's easy to say, you connect Moses, you connect manna to one, and all of a sudden it becomes Moses who provides the manna, doesn't it? Equally, in the same way, it's not Elisha who multiplies the bread. It's God. That it's that, it's I am. It's God who does those things. It was God who provided the bread. And so we have this profound and perhaps complex statement from Jesus. I am the bread of life. Connecting himself very much to that gift of grace, that grace gift, which was manna in the desert. On one hand, the statement of Jesus' divinity, again, connecting you back to that I am statement. On the other hand, the beginning of a covenantal truth, which echoes from the past, but is very much front and center towards a new birth and a new beginning, which is very much a theme running through John. You've seen this regenerative work of God that's been evident in a lot of the chapters that we've brought to you. We see that there's this vein of incredibly strong and provocative language then that Jesus goes into, that we know becomes difficult for those that would hear it because of their response at the end of the chapter, as we've mentioned, and the great fallout that happens. But this is a grand and a key section of John because this is a salvation song. Up to this point, Jesus in John's gospel has brought abundant wine as a sign of joy at the wedding of Cana. He's helped us to understand what it means to have living water as Jesus speaks with the woman at the well. And now we have presented to us an understanding of what it means to be sustained by living bread. This is John covering all the bases for us, isn't it? And it's a prediction of a future moment and an introduction to the disciples, even if a lot of them can't get their heads around it. It's effectively an announcement of the Last Supper. It's Jesus introducing the theme so that the disciples can begin to get their heads around it. This is an amazing statement of Jesus about the sustenance of life. As a fundamental of life, as a primary part of life, that there's such an urgency to the way that Jesus presents this to us. He says, I am the bread of life. You need nothing else than me, Jesus says, effectively. That I am so fundamental to your existence that you cannot do without me. You can't live, he says, without the body and blood, and not your own, but mine in your life. The response of the people is then grumbling. I wish that was a surprise, don't you? But actually the response of the people was grumbling and whinging, which I'm sure none of us would do in that situation. But for them, it's that sense of incredulity that this was Joseph's son. That we know this family, that we've seen this lad. So how can you say that this is him coming down from heaven? How can he say that this is who he is? How can he say that he is as important as he is? Because we've seen him grow. He's flesh and blood like the rest of us. And that this is Jesus saying something much deeper. In connecting himself to that manna from heaven, in saying, I am the bread of life, he's saying, here I am as the embodiment of grace and truth and life, that I will sustain you through this. But I'll be honest, I have a bit of sympathy for the crowds, because this is such provocative language, isn't it? That if you read this out of context, if you read this without any sense of understanding, this is Jesus talking about eating his flesh. This is talk about Jesus taking his blood. And remember that for the Jew, anything with blood in it, meat that had blood in it, was something that would defile you. That this was something that would make you unclean according to the law. There was no medium rare steak at this point. But this is something new and something different for this Jewish mentality. Actually, I think what this is about in part is the difference between Jesus' flesh and blood and ours. And again, if you want to read further into Paul, you see that actually the word flesh itself becomes synonymous for the sinful nature, the ways in which we are restricted and flawed and such. This word sarx, it's the same word, it's exactly the same word that Jesus is using, my flesh and blood. But it's that difference between his flesh and blood and ours, isn't it? Because for better and for worse, the very best of that which we will do is contaminated by our flesh and blood, by our sinful nature. The very best moments of our life are still sinful nature. The very best of who we are is still that sense of just normal human flesh. And yet, in Jesus, there's something different. In Jesus, there's something special. In Jesus, there is something extraordinary, because he was who he was. I am who I am. And it's that great difference between him and us. And Jesus presents this to us, and he says, look, if you can in any way just take on my flesh, if you can take on my being, if you can eat of me and drink of me, if you can hold on to that, you will absorb my nature, almost is what he's saying. That you take on the nutrition that I am. You could take on my personality. You take me on. That your flesh and blood will be changed, transformed into something that is more of my likeness. That you're capable of a different kind of goodness and righteousness as you take me on into yourself. And again, it's this sense of rebirth and regeneration in John, isn't it? He's talked to us so vividly and lots of different, that there's a need for this transformation within us, that we need to change. And I wonder how much we hold on to that, actually. Because it isn't just once, is it? Let's be honest. But actually, it's this continual process of change, this regeneration after regeneration after regeneration. It's bit by bit, it's measure by measure, it's mouthful by mouthful, Jesus says, so that I can become part of you. It's not weird mysticism, actually. It's not cannibalism by any means, though you can understand why some people would accuse Christians of that over the ages. It's not even transubstantiation. I love saying that word. If you don't know what it means, look it up. But actually, it's rather about a deep theological change that we need to be more like him. That we need to feed on him, to take his yoke upon us, that we need to be transformed by him. We need to understand what it means for us in the letter to Colossians, where it says it's Christ in us, the hope of glory. So your choice is the same this morning as those who found it hard to hear all of those years ago. Will you take on Jesus? Will you receive him? Will you be changed by him? And lose your grip, perhaps, on many things that you thought were important? Are you willing to let go for him? Let's take some time to pray. Father, we just take on the challenge of your word this morning and ask in these moments that you would challenge us, stir our hearts, speak to us, and help us to respond to your word. As the prayer team were praying this morning, before our service, two things came up. And if this is you, we'll encourage you to pray with the team after the service. First one, a picture of a man wearing a chef's hat and the words, "Don't do it." Secondly, a picture of a chunk of gold and the words, "Do not lust over silver and gold, but crave for me and my truth." So we hold those words up before the Lord. And if that's something relevant to you, if that means something to you, then we encourage you to respond.